risk and volatility are not synonyms for each other. I'm a big fan of kind of Warren Buffett. And I think, you know, a lot of things talked about is that it's permanent capital impairment is loss. But if I buy at 10, it goes down to 5 and goes up to 20. I never actually lost money along the way. It was only if I sold at 5 that I lost money. You know, not that people don't care about volatility, but seeing it as not quite the same thing as risk. It's not like gambling where you just, you know, can go up or down.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager due diligence or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
For me, the best part of my podcasting journey has been the opportunity to speak to a huge range of extraordinary investors from all around the world. In this series, I have invited one of them, namely Alan Dunn, to host a series of in-depth conversations on the topic of what it takes to be a world-class allocator. In today's world, portfolio construction is fast moving to the top of the agenda of many investors as they try to analyze and understand the riskiness of their portfolios. And with ever-increasing uncertainty around the globe, being well-diversified across many different strategies and themes in your portfolio can mean the difference between ruin and survival when the next crisis emerges. The aim of these conversations is to try and understand the experiences that have influenced these highly specialized allocators and the processes they follow to harness the best returns for their clients so that we can all become better informed investors. And with that, please welcome Alan Dunn.
Thanks for that introduction, Niels. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Tad Fallows. Tad is MD of Long Angle. Long Angle is a private digital community of highly successful young entrepreneurs and executives. Community is comprised of high net worth millennials and Gen Xers around the world, about 3,000 members across 45 countries with a collective AUM of $30 billion. Prior to starting Long Angle, Tad founded a SaaS company, which he successfully exited. And prior to that, he was at McKinsey for a number of years. Tad, it's great to have you with us. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me here, Alan. I'm thrilled to be here. Doing very well.
Good stuff. Well, I gave a bit of a sense of your background, and it is different to a lot of the other kind of asset allocation guests that we've had on. But I think it's a very interesting background, and it's a very interesting community you're involved in. So maybe give us a sense on how you got involved in, your overall journey to Long Angle.
Yeah, it's a great question, and really excited to be here. Love the podcast. In the question of my investment journey or allocation journey, first exposure was probably when I was about 8 years old. This one really hit me because it was my grandparents who, what they did for both my brother and I is my grandfather had been an entrepreneur and then a, you know, lifetime investor. And so they set up sort of trial stock accounts for each of my brother and I, where they would put in a few dollars each month. And, you know, we'd research the stocks and they'd enter it in their ledger book. You know, this was the late 80s. So before a lot of electronic tools that we have today, but got us excited about that process. My grandmother actually just passed away two days ago. So she was 102, had a very full life, but I think she left a lot of legacies. But that was certainly one of getting my brother and I very interested in business and investing. We both went on to become entrepreneurs ourselves. I think that interest in companies continued, you know, throughout life, whether it was in high school. I preferred during the summers to start companies with my friends rather than having to get a traditional job of working at the grocery store. And then, as you said, after college, I went on to work at McKinsey before starting a SaaS company. So always had a lot of interest in businesses and how companies made money. And I would say hobbyist investing along the way, trying to translate some of that to buying public equities here and there. And I think probably the biggest thing that gave to my investing perspective was really seeing at least public equities as ownership shares in companies rather than as ticker symbols with prices on them, which, you know, my perspective is that is actually critical to long-term success in investing, because when you see prices drop 50%, you know, as I don't know if it's Warren Buffett or someone like that said, it's the only store where when they put on a 50% off sale, everybody runs out. And then when prices go up, everybody piles in. So I think if you can keep that mindset of seeing them as buying companies and not pieces of paper, leads to more success long run. But then I think the biggest step change in terms of really focusing a lot of my time, or, you know, majority of my focus on portfolio allocation and then beyond, you know, just public equities to really the whole suite of portfolio allocation, was probably when I had that liquidity event from the software company that you mentioned. So as you said, I'd been at McKinsey for a few years and then spent about 10 years bootstrapping a software company focused on universities and hospitals, got it to about 75 employees, and then sold it to a strategic acquirer. And so that process meant that we made very little money throughout my career, and then on one day basically got deferred compensation for the last 10 years. And at that point, I also had a little more free time to focus on my personal finances, no longer running a company. And as I looked at all the different things I could spend my time trying to optimize, whether it was, you know, getting your 401ks and retirement plans right, or, you know, killing recurring subscriptions, or, you know, credit cards, or any of those sort of things, and then compare that to the impact of, okay, if I get asset allocation right and I get an extra 1% returns here, that is going to swamp anything else I could possibly do. You know, I can be sloppy about how often I go out to dinner or, you know, any of those things if I'm actually successful at getting portfolio allocation correctly. So really, you know, did a deep dive on that. And for me, I think for a lot of people, when they go through a liquidity event, it then becomes sort of moving into wealth preservation mode, perhaps because of some, you know, combination of my age being, you know, my late 30s when that happened, as well as, you know, the sort of lifetime experience in business. It wasn't so much that my risk appetite went down a lot. You know, I've been through market cycles like 2001 and 2008 with at least modest exposure. So sort of knew that both those downturns do end and that they are good buying opportunities, and that I was personality-wise capable of staying invested through those, so didn't need to go to just sort of a traditional 60-40 portfolio. So I was much more interested in maximizing returns, but also in options where you can mute the volatility without sacrificing long-term returns. And I think, you know, probably the really clarifying moment for me came when I interviewed a number of wealth managers after liquidity event, as I thought about working with one of them and sort of outsourcing that effort. And super sharp guy, you know, actually a pretty good friend of mine, his pitch was basically, hey, what we do is we can bring you half of the market return for a quarter of the volatility. So, you know, double the Sharpe ratio. And, you know, my response to him was, okay, if you can do that Sharpe ratio, I want four times the return for twice the volatility. You know, I'm not using the money for 30 years. So what I care about is the final destination. And I don't really care that much about the path to get there. I think, you know, he basically looked at me like I'd used foul language at that point. And I realized, okay, you know, I'm not a good fit for this. I need to, you know, personally get deep and focus on understanding the asset allocation deeply. And that was, I think, closely involved to starting Long Angle. So what that was is, again, as I mentioned with the liquidity event, it was a fairly abrupt introduction to a lot of the more esoteric high net worth questions where, you know, if as someone who's a personal finance hobbyist, you know, could understand a lot of these things around setting up 529 plans or 401k plans or, you know, low cost ETFs and that sort of thing. But when you get into these questions of private equity and private credit or estate taxes or things like that, you know, trust structures, there was a lot less information out there. And so, you know, wanted to do a deep dive on that and basically wanted to make sure I was getting that information from people who are first person in the same situation and not trying to sell each other anything. So my co-founder of my last company and I worked together to set this up. And what we started was just putting together a group of about a dozen other entrepreneurs or hedge fund managers who are in a similar situation financially to, you know, speak openly about what they were doing on any of those topics. It turned out that need was a lot more broadly felt. So as you mentioned, over the past 3 years, we've grown to about 3,000 members, still in that same demographic of mostly very high net worth, mostly under 50. As you mentioned, you know, more geographies and more professional backgrounds there, although entrepreneurs probably being, you know, the single biggest background along with things like finance and technology. And so there's a number of parts to that, whether that is online discussions of people talking about whether they're the more quantitative questions around asset allocation and tax optimization, or the more qualitative questions around, hey, how do I take advantage of this wealth to give my children opportunities without spoiling them or, you know, undermining their ability to succeed on their own merits, as well as a number of, you know, in-person events, webinar meetups, sort of peer advisory groups and things like that. But one significant aspect of this, not necessarily the intent initially, but emerged over time, was around alternative asset deals, both analysis and then, you know, syndication of to get access to and discounts on alternative asset deals. So where we have, you know, gotten to this point is that we basically look at probably 50 or 100 deals a year. The kind of mechanism there is that from across our membership, there's a whole lot of people who, you know, either have had success with particular managers or, you know these people from their professional careers and sort of suggest, hey, this could be an interesting fund for us to look at. We have a few people on our team do the initial level of analysis on them, looking at things like, you know, track record, fee structure, tax structure, idiosyncratic risk, correlation, et cetera, to get down to the handful each month that we think are promising. And then for those, actually put together a member deal team of a handful of members who really know that particular asset class very well, whether that is upstream oil and gas production, you know, medical office roll-ups, private credit, real estate, you know, any of the above, and do a deep dive on it. And then about once a month, there's one that expert deal team, people who work in that industry, really like a lot. And then for that, we basically do a syndicate investment opportunity across the community where we say we can then negotiate with the GP and say, all right, if we're writing, rather than, you know, individually someone writing a $100,000 check, collectively writing a $10 million check, sometimes that's access, sometimes that's discounts, you know, sometimes that's both of the above. And so that whole process, you know, being closely involved there has really sort of turbocharged my learning about a wide variety of asset classes and both understand, you know, being aware of ones I just had no idea existed before, things maybe like search funds or whiskey aging, or getting, you know, much more nuanced understanding of what are the economic drivers and the return drivers on, you know, specific asset classes that maybe vaguely aware of, and maybe in some cases even dabbled in without really understanding what the kind of fundamental drivers of performance were.
Okay, great. Well, that's a very comprehensive overview. I mean, it's interesting you touched on, you know, being in your late 30s, not wanting that kind of quarter to vol and half the return type risk reward profile. I mean, would you say that's pretty representative of the risk appetite of most of your peers within Long Angle?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, I wouldn't claim to speak for everybody. Of course, like any group of 3,000 people, you'll have a dispersion of opinions. I would say, though, that people on average tend toward the higher end of the risk spectrum. One thing that we do is we run a asset allocation survey every year where we ask all of our members across maybe 60 different categories, how do you allocate your portfolio? Then we gather that data, we synthesize it, we actually publish it on our website. So it's not something we're, you know, charging for or keeping secret, but just something that we think is very interesting. But the outcome of that is, on a mean basis, only about 14% of total net worth is in either cash or bonds. You know, more than half of it being in equities, whether that's public equity or private equity, and the rest in, you know, real estate or other alternatives. So I think that 14% cash and bond allocation, I'm pretty sure, is lower than, you know, the traditional advice for those lower risk asset classes. You know, I think there's two ways generically that one could talk about it. If you're in a situation where you have, you know, more money than you are likely to consume in your lifetime, you could either say, hey, I've got plenty of money, I don't need to take any risk, I can just put it all in municipal bonds and withdraw, you know, 0.5% a year and I'm fine. Or you'd say, I've got a lot of money, I can afford a lot of volatility. So, you know, why would I spend the next 50 years with my money sitting there in municipal bonds and just being eaten away by inflation? Why don't I just put it all in the assets with the highest expected returns, and over 50 years, my actual returns are going to tend toward the median, and I'll end up with, you know, 10 times as much money I can either donate to charity, leave to my heirs, have, you know, other impact with. I think they're both very logically consistent and valid perspectives. And I would say, you know, as I said, most members probably tend toward the higher return. And I think part of it is, I was going to say they're high risk, high return. I think there's a perspective, which I certainly share myself and probably goes with a number of our members, is that risk and volatility are not synonyms for each other. I think volatility is helpful where you can run lots of analysis on it. You have modern portfolio theory, you have Sharpe ratios, you can calculate Monte Carlo scenarios, but it's not really the same thing as risk. Again, you know, I'm a big fan of kind of Warren Buffett. I think, you know, a lot of things talked about is that it's permanent capital impairment is loss, but if I buy at 10, it goes down to 5 and goes up to 20. I never actually lost money along the way. It was only if I sold at 5 that I lost money. And so I think probably that, you know, not that people don't care about volatility, but seeing it as not quite the same thing as risk. It's not like gambling where you just, you know, can go up or down.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And the, I mean, a couple of points on that. I mean, is it that, would you say it's primarily the age profile, or is it the fact that these are entrepreneurs or probably made the wealth themselves? Or is it a function of these people have grown up in a great period to be an investor in the United States that they haven't seen? Well, okay, you've had the financial crisis, but things, you know, came through it. I mean, are all of those relevant in terms of kind of, I suppose, building this risk profile of the people, of your members?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Again, without, you know, speaking for every individual person, I can look at the statistics and I can say age has some, but a pretty mild impact. You know, if I bucket our members into, you know, broad groups of those maybe under 40, 40 to 50 and more than 50, you know, the folks in the over 50 group, rather than having 15% in stocks and bonds, they've got 20%. So slightly less aggressive, but still, you know, significantly more similar than different. I think that probably the key drivers across there are a few things. One is, you know, you mentioned first generation versus second or third generation wealth. I think that is a major driver of things. Our community is probably 95, 98% first generation wealth creators, but we do have a handful of people who are G2 or G3 or more from their families. And actually some of my favorite members think they bring, you know, very sophisticated perspectives. And there are certain things that you learn, especially perhaps around raising kids, where having been through it yourself on the other side, you have a strong perspective on what works and what doesn't. But I do think there tends to be significantly more risk appetite with a person who says, hey, I worked really hard. I made $20 million. I sure don't want to lose it. But if I did, I'm not, you know, really worried about what's going to happen tomorrow. I know I'm capable of generating wealth and I can probably, you know, roll up my sleeves and do it again. Versus I think if I inherited $100 million, there's probably some obligation here to pass on to the next generation and not be the guy who screwed it up and you know, broke the chain there. And I think also probably just less control or less direct control where, and if you start and sell your company, then you've got the cash in your personal bank account. And you probably should do things for estate planning and liability protection to put it into various trusts, but you don't have to. Whereas if you inherit that money, it's often, you know, different things in different pots where you have different decision rights over them. So I think that that's a little bit of it. And then maybe the last thing also is, aside from the question of whether you generated this wealth and had comfort in the ability to redo that if you had to, I think there's just having operated a business for a long time in many cases, or, you know, maybe being a senior executive or working in finance, feeling a real understanding of what kind of those economic drivers there are. And so again, as I mentioned, for myself, seeing a lot of these equity-like positions as ownership stakes as opposed to just, you know, numbers and ticker symbols, I think, you know, feeling more comfort with that allocation. Probably unanswerable what you're saying about how much is just personal experience bias of, hey, you know, as you said, there have been drawdowns like 2001, 2007, or, you know, COVID, but COVID probably the best example where things just bounce back so fast. You know, I can tell you that I stayed fully invested and did some buying in 2001, 2008, but, you know, those didn't test patience and faith the way that, say, you know, 1968 to 82, something like that, where the market basically stayed flat for 15 years, or in Japan, have we, you know, just re-reached the all-time high for the Nikkei. I actually lived there when I was about 7 years old. And I think, you know, the market's in the same place there as it was when I was seven. So, you know, that I'm sure there's a bit of that, especially if you look at tech stocks where, you know, a significant number of our members, either tech entrepreneurs or, you know, early employees at a public tech company. And I think when I looked at it last, over the last 10 years, the Dow Jones Tech Index has averaged over 20% IRR. And so, yeah, I think that's certainly, you know, it is correct that equities overperform that over the long run, but probably not to the degree that they have for the last 30 years.
And I mean, obviously, when you had your wealth event and your liquidity event, you took the time to kind of consider what to do going forward. And as you say, you spoke to kind of wealth management firms, I guess, or, you know, and I mean, outside of that kind of vol profile, I mean, when you looked at the offering, obviously you concluded that you could do something better yourselves. And was it just that the greater access to kind of deals, private markets, all of that, that you felt that you was better served kind of going your own route than going like the traditional route with a kind of a bulge bracket wealth manager?
Yeah, another great question. I would say, honestly, for me, a big part of it was the cost structure, where when you, let's say, again, you've got $100,000 and you're paying 1%. Okay, I'm paying $1,000 a year for this advice. That advice certainly costs money and, you know, requires expertise and is going to help me out. Of course, when you have a bigger portfolio, those numbers are going to go down, but they don't go down as far or as fast as it feels like they ought to. So if you're talking about, you know, let's say a $20 million portfolio and you're talking about 75 basis points on that, you know, that's $150,000 a year and all post-tax money. So that's, you know, $300,000 a year of pre-tax money. It just feels like an awfully big number, and one where you're saying, okay, is my time really that valuable, or can I, you know, invest some of my time to figure this out myself? So I think a bit of it is just, you know, the size of the numbers there. And I think I would probably be, you know, speaking with my general membership when I say that this sort of legacy of focusing on AUM-based fee structures as opposed to, you know, hourly fee structures like most other professional services, people say, hey, I'm happy to pay my lawyer $1,000 an hour. I can pay my wealth manager $1,000 an hour. You know, my lawyer doesn't demand a cut of every deal that he writes the documents for. So there's probably a bit of that. Again, as you get higher in the sort of assets under management, it becomes also a lot broader spectrum of services that could be defined as, for example, family office or wealth management, where it's not just portfolio allocation, but you can things like, you know, legal services, you can get into, you know, tax services, into bill pay services, property management services, et cetera. And I think a lot of those are things that, you know, I personally and a lot of the members, you know, find interesting of saying, hey, you know, probably the portfolio allocation is the single piece that people feel the most comfort and the most interest in keeping control over. But a lot of those ancillary services, either for, you know, a lack of interest, a lack of expertise, a lack of time, you know, be much more interested in outsourcing. I think it probably also lastly comes down to personal interest, where there are, you know, I personally have an appetite and, you know, find this stuff interesting to work on. You know, if I passed away early, I would certainly advise my wife to, you know, find a wealth manager to help her with it. Not at all for a lack of expertise. She is, you know, much smarter than I am and happens to work in banking, but she just doesn't find this stuff particularly interesting. And so, you know, I'll give her the check-in every few months or every year about how we're doing, so she stays fully informed, but just, you know, wouldn't want to do it yourself. So I think there's also an element of, you know, having the same kind of people who would personally want to become a wealth manager for other people. You know, they're going to probably want to manage their own portfolio because they just have an appetite for learning about it.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. So picking up on some of the points you made around the asset allocation survey, so it sounded like broadly about 50-odd percent equities, I think, 14%, I think you said, in kind of cash bonds and the balance. So kind of 50, 35, 15, I guess, which is kind of an interesting 35% in real estate and alternatives. Was that right?
Yeah, it was more than half in equities. It's actually, you know, more like 55 or 60% equities. So not quite as heavy, you know, under 30% real estate, probably 25 to 30 in real estate. And that split maybe half and half between equity in your primary residence and an investment real estate. I know there's a debate about whether primary residence should be considered part of net worth or not. But as we look at it, just say, hey, what's your total equity? You know, you could sell your house and downsize if you want to. So it is an asset that you own. And actually interesting there, just on, you know, some kind of interesting observations that came out of that study, which are a little different than you might expect. One, on primary residence, it's interesting that you see pretty consistently up to about $25 million of net worth that people have about 20% of their portfolio in equity in their primary residence. I would have expected a lot steeper curve of, you know, people with say 5 million to have a much bigger amount than people with 25 million, but it's much closer to flat than you expect. When you get deeper into the ultra high net worth territory of 50 or 100 million, of course, that, you know, percentage of that in your primary residence does go down fairly steeply. What's interesting on the risk reward that we found there, or, you know, risk volatility and return appetite is that while there's much less allocation to cash and bonds, there is also much less debt than you'd probably expect. We ask people, okay, how much leverage do you have? And is it on, you know, mortgages on investment properties or residences or, you know, portfolio lines of credit and that sort of thing? And the majority of members, well more than half of them, had less than 10% of their net worth in debt, you know, including real estate debt. Almost half of them actually didn't even carry a mortgage, either because they didn't own a home or in most cases because they owned a home and didn't want to put any debt on it. So it's sort of the flip side of the money that I have, the capital I have to invest, I'm going to invest aggressively, but not lever up so that I'm not at risk of a capital call or, you know, some disaster scenario. Again, logic, and actually it does not apply to myself. I have a lot more aggressive approach to leverage than our average member. So I'm not going to say that's the only right way to do it, but I certainly see the reasons behind it. Other things that might be just sort of a little surprising. One is there's a larger allocation to private equity than you might expect, where on average it's about 16%. And then as you get into the ultra high net worth territory, about 25% of people's net worth is tied up in private equity. And that's probably a combination of legacy shares in businesses they start, where if I start something, it goes public, or maybe I sell it to a private equity acquirer, but I roll part of my ownership stake into that. You just sort of accumulate those assets, as well as people intentionally allocating fresh capital to them. And then the last one's interesting is actually a lot less allocation to individual public equities than you'd expect. It's only about maybe 5% of people's portfolio are in individual stock names. Okay, I'm going to go heavy on Apple or Amazon or Nvidia or, you know, what have you. Much, you know, the very large majority of that public equity exposure is in funds of various sorts as opposed to individual stock picking, which I think is a good and responsible idea. I'm impressed because, you know, I always find it more interesting to pick an individual stock than I do to, you know, pick a mutual fund. But that is how people are voting with their wallets.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm surprised. I would have thought they would be kind of tech-heavy stock portfolios, but interesting that they are kind of widely diversified. And also the lack of debt, interesting too, because I was going to raise that in relation to kind of the global financial crisis. Obviously, that's where people got into trouble refinancing real estate deals, etc. So all very sensible, you'd have to say. I mean, in terms of, you know, that interest in the private markets, obviously a higher exposure to private equity. I mean, within privates, I think you touched on search funds very briefly. That's something I'm not as familiar with, but maybe talk us about some of the kind of the private market exposures that you see people invested in.
Yeah, so, you know, as you know, private markets and alternative assets, they're sort of, it's kind of like a fractal where the more you look at it, the more, you know, sub niches and genres there. So, you know, but I can talk about some of the ones that, you know, both I've found interesting that I think a lot of our members tended to be attracted to. So within private equity, I would say, you know, it's a good asset class overall. Certainly, if you look at the long-term track record, you get, I would say, on average, you know, greater than public equity returns. Now, whether you have greater or less volatility, that's probably really in the eye of the beholder. I think, you know, KKR will tell you it's less volatility. I personally believe a lot of that is just driven by the lack of price discovery, where if, you know, public markets are marking every single day, and so you get emotion coming into it. Whereas if, you know, a big PE fund just has to get an accountant to give you a NAV statement every year, you know, it's going to look much more smooth. Again, not necessarily a bad thing. It prevents panic selling, but I think the volatility, in my opinion, is probably more just a reflection of low liquidity. But that said, I think good returns in private equity. And then the subset of private equity that I think I've seen a lot of interest in, especially lately, but just in general, is on the smaller side, because I think you can really get a few tailwinds in your favor if you're looking at buying companies with even maybe as small as, you know, 1 million or 2 million or 5 million of EBIT, where you get generically a private equity company will want to do some at least modest things with leverage to enhance returns. They'll generically want to improve operations and then, you know, run a good exit process to increase their multiple. And basically on all three of those, you have more potential to do it on a very small scale. You know, I'll start with multiple arbitrage. There is, as you know, a lot of your investors are probably aware, if you're buying things at 2 or 3 million of EBIT, of course, it depends on the industry, but in any industry, you will have a lower EBIT multiple than if you are buying things at 10 or 20 or 50 million of EBIT. So if you can buy, let's say, a company with 2.5 million of earnings at 5x revenue, and then you were able through good operations to grow that to 10 million of earnings, well, you've gotten 4x your earnings there, but you can probably move that 5 million to maybe 8 million. So now you paid, 12.5 million to buy it, and then you sell it for 80 million. Some of that was driven by improving the operations, but some of that was just driven by multiple arbitrage. And so I think those strategies, you know, can either be done by your sort of small cap or micro cap private equity firms, or they can be done by search funds, as you mentioned. In some ways, these are just two things along the same spectrum. But what a search fund is, and as you know, happy to kind of go into a little detail there, because at least I was not very aware of it until it got much deeper into this. Generically, it means that there is someone who is a recently minted MBA grad, or maybe a couple of them, often from a top business school. I think Harvard and Stanford were traditionally, you know, two hotbeds of this. It's probably gotten a little bit more democratized, but not a great deal more democratized in recent years. But those people will say, hey, I want to spend the next 1 to 2 years looking for a great company to buy, typically in this same range I was talking about there of maybe 1 to 5 million of EBIT. And I'm a new MBA grad, so I don't have $10 million sitting around to buy this company. I don't even maybe have $250,000 sitting around to fund myself in the meantime. But I will go to a funder there, and there's people who are often previous searchers themselves, or it's become a little bit more institutionalized with some institutional capital, but still quite small. But they will say, all right, I will give you, Alan, $50,000 for the next 2 years to sort of cover your bills while you're doing this. And four buddies of mine are going to do the same. So you've got your $250,000 here. And what we get in return, there's a few things, but basically we get right of first return of if you find a company to invest in. At that point, I can either say, hey, you know, good job of giving my money back, I'm not interested. Or more often, yes, I now want to write $1 million check to get in at, you know, 10 or 20% ownership on this opportunity here. And then it has exactly those dynamics I talked about, where typically they're, by buying a small company, you both have multiple arbitrage. You also typically will have, on average, more opportunities to improve the operations where, you know, if you're a huge PE firm buying a publicly listed company, of course, things can be improved. But if I'm buying $1 million profit company from the founder who maybe, you know, is making enough money and is not squeezing every, you know, nickel out of operations, there can be some more low-hanging fruits to improve there. And maybe you'll do a bit of roll-up of acquiring, you know, complementary or competitive businesses to achieve that critical mass. But the economic outcomes have been over the last 30 to 40 years when this model has existed is returns in the mid-30s IRR consistently year after year there. And Stanford University, if you Google the Stanford Search Fund study, you'll see they're sort of the gold standard of research on this. And that's not just driven by the top, you know, two or three company outliers of, you know, dragging up the whole average that, as I spoke with one person who's a full-time investor in this, he basically equates it to venture type risk with private equity or venture type returns with private equity type risks. So, you know, you can get those 5 to 10x returns with some frequency, but with much fewer of the catastrophic losses than you'd get by being an angel investor. So that's an example of an asset class that, you know, didn't know about, very interesting within private equity, you know, because of those reasons I spoke about. Yeah, I think the challenge there is really around getting access, where if you look worldwide of this asset class, you're probably talking at maybe $1 billion of AUM here. So just, you know, trivial. And if you're running the CalPERS fund, there's probably really not much that you can do with this asset class because it just can't absorb enough capital. But if you're an individual investor, of course, yeah, that's more money than most of us have. And so it can sort of accept as much as you're willing to allocate to it. But the challenge again being getting access, and, you know, there's generically two ways to do it. You can either be a professor at Harvard or Stanford Business School or be a, you know, former searcher yourself and be plugged into that network and, you know, just get the call, get opportunities to join the board, get opportunities to invest. You know, that's not me. It's probably not you. The other thing that has evolved probably over the last maybe 20 years is there's a handful of sponsors who were those individuals themselves and then basically have begun to syndicate those opportunities. So again, they're typically running small funds of maybe 50, you know, 150 million kind of funds where they'll spread it across, you know, maybe 30 of these search fund opportunities. Even getting access, you know, identifying those good sponsors, gaining access to them is more complex than in some other asset classes. But, you know, that's, you know, we actually spend a lot of time. We have done a number of our syndicated deals through Long Angle investing in these because it's just a very interesting risk return category. And, you know, we have a number of former searchers as members who are able to, you know, get their advice and their introductions to sort of get in with some of the better sponsors there.
Makes sense. Sounds fantastic. We all like the sound of those kind of VC type returns with less risk. I suppose a couple of questions. One would be, I mean, it does sound like there's an element of kind of a structural element to that kind of that multiple arbitrage, as you described it, presumably because at higher levels of EBITDA, there's more capital that's interested. So that's where it arises. I mean, taking maybe a more not skeptical would be a bit strong, but play devil's advocate, how much of these returns are a function of the markets we've been in? Obviously, it's been a fantastic environment for this type of risk, private equity, low bond yields, rising equities, et cetera. Do you still see these type of opportunities as being resilient to a kind of a changed macro environment looking ahead?
Yeah, I would say for search funds in particular, I think so. I wouldn't say that to all. I think there certainly are some asset classes that are much more sensitive to that. Like, I mean, if you look at venture, for example, they have had a lot of challenges recently. And I was actually speaking with a friend of mine about this, and you know, he was expressing skepticism on the theory that high interest rates are really going to crush venture. It just sort of seemed, you know, too cute of a narrative. But I do think there actually is a real mechanism there where if you look at something like, you know, Google or Facebook or Amazon, their future returns really are discounted as interest rates go up fivefold. That really does discount the value of earnings 30 years from now to probably a more realistic number. And then that translates through, as you're saying, to the amount that, you know, venture capitalists, as they look at investing in their next, you know, lotto ticket here. Okay, if this is successful, now I'm getting market to my public comps and my potential upside has gone down a lot. So I certainly think that there are ones. If I look at search funds in particular, just as an example, I don't think that they are particularly sensitive to this, I'd say for a couple of reasons. One is just that if you look at things like the Stanford data over the last 40 years, there have been a few different market cycles there, and you've seen these returns be a lot more consistent than different. A second is that the drivers of return, at least in that case, are not particularly sensitive to whether the tech market is up or down. So again, if you think about the drivers of return being first, we are going to improve the operations of this company and drive EBIT. Second, we are going to get a higher multiple. And then third, we are going to run probably a more professional exit process of, you know, working with a banker and having things more cleaned up than when we bought it. None of those are really sensitive, you know, to the economic. You could argue the EBIT multiple is sensitive to the economic environment, but I think still the relative, no matter how bad the economy, you're always going to get a better multiple on a larger company than a smaller company. And again, that doesn't, you know, that's across any industry, any company, as you're saying, just, you know, your big institutional capital does not want to buy something that has $1 million of EBIT. They want to buy into something with $100 million of EBIT or $1 billion of EBIT. And so you're always going to get a bigger multiple on the higher ones. And also, I think you have to look at the level of debt involved and leverage involved with a particular asset class. Like if I were to look at what are people investing in more today than they were 3 years ago? And I think probably highly correlated with that, what has a better setup today than it does 3 years ago? Probably the biggest thing is what is the amount of impact of leverage on an asset class? So if I look today at real estate, I know myself personally and our community overall has very muted appetite for real estate, where with interest rates having gone up so much and you really have not seen cap rates move to the same degree of interest rates, you just get this bid-ask spread where you have rational actors on each side. You have the rational seller who's saying, well, my interest rates are locked in at 3%, so I'm not going to sell, you know, to make the numbers work for you at 8%. And the rational buyer says, well, I have to borrow at 8%, so I don't care what your interest rate is. And so where you end up is just a lack of transaction volume with everyone acting rationally there. Whereas if you look 3 years ago, again, speaking a combination of personally, if I look at the community, I was very much all in on real estate and, you know, actually made a very big purchase about 3 years ago where I probably put maybe, you know, 40 or 50% of my net worth into a particular real estate deal because I just said, hey, look, I can lock in 30-year debt at 2.5% here. Inflation is already above 2.5% and it's clearly going higher just if you look at, you know, government spending and the size of deficits we're running and a bunch of other factors. And so you know, had confidence in the micro market and the economics of that deal, but, you know, I'm very comfortable making a large allocation there today, 3 years ago, where I would not make that today. And I think the flip side of stuff that becomes more attractive in a high rate environment would probably be something like, you know, either general bonds, or maybe if you look more on the alternative side, things like private credit, which is typically priced at a premium to the, you know, underlying risk-free interest rate. And so, you know, today I think there's a lot of interesting private credit opportunities in the 10 to 12% range. And if you're able to really, you know, do deeper research and roll up your sleeves and, you know, find some niche opportunities, probably more in the, you know, mid to high teens in terms of relatively low risk private credit, those are just better returns than I think were available a few years ago in a lower interest rate world.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, curious to get your thoughts. I mean, one of the things that comes up strongly when I'm talking to investors, but also macro commentators, is, you know, the shift in the macro environment. Obviously, we're talking about higher rates. We've had higher inflation. But looking ahead, you know, there are certain structural themes: deglobalization, decarbonization, you know, rising geopolitical risk, greater defense spending. All of these themes that kind of shape a narrative that the world that we live in is going to be different in the next 10 years, you know, possibly higher inflation, maybe more favorable for things like commodities, for mining, for materials, all of that. Are they themes that you find resonate with your community, or do people, you know, are they more driven by things like the same industries that they have been looking at for the last number of years, except that you've got these higher yields and things like private credit, or are they kind of motivated by those kind of big picture structural themes, would you say?
I think on average, people are probably more interested in the micro than the macro, where you say, hey, you know, if I can find the next NVIDIA, it doesn't really matter what's happening to the market, you know, a company that is picking up 50% market share every year and has great margins is going to sort of thrive in any economy. And that's probably your general venture, you know, venture capital thesis, is that they can outgrow the economy. But it doesn't only apply to venture, of course, by any means, where, again, if you look at private equity and firms that specialize in some, you know, cleanups and turnarounds or, you know, roll-up strategies, that, yeah, the interest in the micro. And I think, you know, generically, if I were to look at what a lot of people really like to invest in, it's probably ones where the underlying return and economic drivers are really pretty transparent and pretty easy to understand. So that, you know, and that doesn't have to be. I've given some examples, one more private equity world. If I were to give a totally different and much non-equity type investment, but again, with at least a economic driver that you can understand, I'd look at something like spirits and whiskey aging. This is another asset class I'd never heard of before, but, you know, your listeners might find interesting, where the generic dynamic in that market is that for, I'll look at like Kentucky bourbon in the US, which is one that I've looked at more closely. For the last, you know, couple of decades, you had dynamic where you can basically buy newly distilled into the barrel whiskey for about $1,000 a barrel. And then the market price for five-year-old whiskey is about $3,000 a barrel. And you have seen this consistent premium aging curve there. Again, that's not necessarily an economic driver. You're not doing anything with that barrel. You actually never even take possession of it. You just get a certificate that says you own this barrel that's sitting in a warehouse in Kentucky somewhere, and it's licensed and bonded and insured. And, you know, you can go touch it if you want to, but you don't ever have to do anything with it. But the economic driver is basically this age premium. And I think part of what's behind that, there's a few things there. But if you think generically, let's say that you want to go start Allen's whiskey brand and you need five-year-old whiskey for it or 10-year-old whiskey, you could say, hey, I want to start that company in 5 or 10 years. And so I'm going to go there and, you know, try and open a factory and distill my whiskey. But you're not going to do that. What you're going to do is you're going to say, I need to go source 5 or 10-year-old whiskey. And the only place you can do that is from somebody who has been an investor sitting on it for the last 5 years. And so you sort of are getting paid to do maybe the patient, less sexy part of the value chain there. And you don't have to build a brand. You're just sort of waiting to be the seller there. And, you know, another thing that just serves as an example of how some of these niche ones have very different risk return profiles. Often what you'd think in looking at something like this, you say, hey, is this a bubble, right? You know, I don't really want to end up, I'm not going to drink 1,000 barrels of whiskey, so I don't want to end up owning them. And, you know, anything with that kind of return profile seems too good to be true. You can't put up 40% IRRs year after year without, you know, flooding the market. So you say, okay, I'm really worried about a bubble here. But then at least if you look at the supply side of the bubble, you can say, okay, I don't really care if people are building factories or not. the only whiskey that can exist 5 years from now as 5-year-old whiskey is whiskey that's already in a barrel today. So if I know it exists today, it does not matter how much other people start, you know, distilling 2 years from now. When I get to 5 years from now, the stuff they distill today is not going to be a competitor with me. So, you know, you still have risks, of course. There it becomes more of a demand side risk, where if China or France or some other country, you know, puts a big tariff on it, or, you know, if preferences change, you certainly can see demand side shocks. But at least it's just interesting. There's examples of one where there you have perfect protection from a supply bubble, you know, because it's a known supply.
So it sounds like you're trying to identify more kind of inefficiencies, structural risk premia that exist for various kind of institutional or structural reasons, and taking advantage of that more so than kind of anticipating kind of structural demand shifts. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, part of that is probably modesty of saying, hey, you know, none of us have better information than the world at large about, you know, what's going to happen with the Ukraine war, what's going to happen with China. You know, efficient market theory says that that is all, you know, baked into the price. And while markets aren't totally efficient, I wouldn't pretend that I'm going to do a better job than the research desk at Goldman Sachs of, you know, determining how those, you know, macro drivers are going to evolve. So yeah, I think probably people feeling like the place where they really can get better information, better analysis is on these smaller, nichier things, where if I'm looking at a fund that has $75 million in total, I'm not competing against Goldman Sachs or CalPERS or, you know, the investment fund of Norway about whether to put my dollars there, because it's just too small for any of them. But it's worth my time to research, and, you know, you can identify. There's certainly also, that means that there are worse deals available as well. I think if you look generically at public markets, at least my personal perspective is, if you have the combination of liquidity and price discovery and government regulation, you're protected on a lot of fronts. And basically, if you just get a dartboard and buy 50 stocks, you're pretty much going to track the index, you know, plus or minus a few. Whereas if you take that approach in private markets, you're pretty certain to trail the index. So on the good side, you have the opportunity outside to outperform. But on the downside, if you're not kind of willing or able to roll up your sleeves and get that information edge, you're probably going to underperform, and then, you know, better off avoiding entirely.
Picking up on a couple of things you haven't talked about, hedge funds is one. I mean, it doesn't really fit within what we're talking about. I mean, is that, often with people who come from real businesses, you know, where they've made money from buying and selling goods or services, the whole hedge fund world, particularly if it's in things like derivatives, can seem like a foreign world. Is it that reason, or is it because they're seen as, you know, more kind of portfolio management tools, or why would you say that it sounds like less interested in things like hedge funds?
Yeah, I think hedge funds in particular are interesting. I would say there's probably a bit, if I'm being fair to the asset class, of recency bias, where if you look over the past 10 or 20 years, public markets, as you said, have performed so well, and their drawdown periods have been relatively brief, that it's like, why would I put money into a hedge fund? I'm going to get lower returns, I'm going to pay higher fees, and I don't really have a problem with volatility in the first place. It's a, you know, bad solution to a problem that doesn't exist. But that would probably look different in an environment that either was much more volatile or where the trend was not so much up and to the right, you know, for public equities. So I think I'd probably be, you know, want to be fair to them that in a different environment, they'd probably be more interesting. I think, however, that this is not unique just to our community. I think if you look in general, a lot of hedge funds have, you know, struggled to raise and struggled to keep their AUM, probably because, you know, a lot of investors have that same perspective of, this is a very expensive product. Its average expected returns are not that high. So, you know, really what's the sales pitch in that? And I think it probably is around, you know, liquidity and muted volatility and that sort of thing. But, you know, again, maybe that will change with a different economic environment. You know, maybe it won't, but I think it's just, you know, if you look at that high level of kind of costs and risks and tax treatment, et cetera, you know, I wouldn't say everyone, of course. You know, if people who run Renaissance Medallion are listening to this, you know, I want to invest and I would like allocation tomorrow. So your best ones are always going to have a lot of interest. I also think hedge fund in general is a very broad, you know, that can really mean just an active, you know, long only fund, or it can be totally market neutral. But, you know, if what you and I are probably implying by hedge fund.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, hedge funds have become a lot more institutional. So they've been, I suppose they have marketed themselves more to large institutions over time. And that's, you know, reflected in maybe lower vol in some strategies, et cetera. I mean, historically, if we went back 20 or 30 years, global macro hedge funds would have been more return seeking, higher vol. But, and even in from our space, things like trend following, some managers still stick to that kind of higher vol approach. So, I mean, presumably, if that could be of interest to some people, if they were shooting for higher returns, is it? But then you might have the challenges around understanding the strategy. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I do think that's fair to say. You know, if I look at trend following in particular, that's one that, just speaking for myself, I have a lot of interest in, because it does, you know, I think the holy grail of investing is saying, hey, I want to get the expected return of my kind of highest risk, highest volatility asset, but then I want to find 20 of those that are totally uncorrelated. And so, you know, I will get exactly that super high return every year with no volatility. And while, of course, that doesn't exist, I think something like trend following is interesting because it does have basically, I mean, as I'm telling you what you already know, but it has typical returns like you'd expect in public equities and imperfect correlation. I don't know if it's, you know, negative correlation or just, you know, closer to zero correlation, but imperfect correlation there. So at the highest level, that's a great place to put a lot of your money. I think the reason that probably our community in general, you know, we haven't done any, you know, syndicated investments into that, you know, probably a couple. One is, I think I haven't figured out a way that we can add alpha and say, hey, you know, if you want this, you can just go buy it from a, you know, trend following company. You don't need to, you know, our diligence isn't necessarily going to add that much to the process. But then probably more so that it does have a little bit of that black box sense of, hey, I love what I got out of this box, but I'm not really sure the underlying economic drivers of, you know, how those returns were generated. And that's probably just a person-to-person thing. But I think there are some people who feel like, hey, if you know, the way I tried to talk through, here's how a search fund makes money, or here's how a whiskey fund makes money. If you said, here's how a trend following fund makes money, at least I probably could not articulate it in a way that didn't involve, you know, numbers and ratios and that kind of thing. I would struggle to put it into plain English. That said, you know, I personally probably have, you know, appetite to do that more than your typical person. And so it's only a certain degree to which you'll argue with success. And that just seems like a good thing to put money into. I know, you know, last year was a very good year for trend following and, you know, helped. And I think my understanding is this year to date has also been, based on the reports I've seen, an extremely good period. So that's nice to see. So yeah, I like it for those reasons.
What about, like, obviously, normally a group of entrepreneurs, maybe with tech backgrounds, you would associate a heavy interest in crypto. But again, I haven't mentioned that. What are the thoughts on crypto?
Yeah. And another one you might say is angel investing. And so, you know, maybe I'll kind of take the angel investing one first, because that might seem like the most obvious one for a group of maybe 40% people who have started and sold companies to say, well, are they going to do a lot of angel? And I think the generic answer is yes, they do a lot of angel. The reason that I have not spoken about much is probably two things. One is, my perspective is that angel and venture, it's funny, that's often the first alternative that people go into, but it's also like jumping into the deep end. That is not the kiddie pool of alternatives. It has the longest time horizons, where, you know, 10 years would not be a surprising amount of time to be illiquid. It has, you know, the least predictability, where it's just a blind pool. I have no idea, you know, what these guys are going to invest in. It has the least ability to measure the track record of the sponsor you're investing with, where I could put my money with Sequoia or General Catalyst, and I know, hey, you know, these guys have been very successful historically and had great returns, and I'd probably be excited to do it. But really, I have no idea what they've been doing for the last 10 years. I just know that 20 and 30 years ago, those guys who probably retired, who worked at Sequoia, did really well. But the person who's making those decisions today, there just hasn't been enough time to prove it. So I think venture and angel tend to be two of the hardest. And of course, it has the highest volatility and the most reliance on just a handful of good performers to drive the whole portfolio. So that's one. The other reason is that, at least, you know, we have not directly, a lot of the things that we tend to spend our time on are ones where we feel like we can really add value by digging into the particular asset class, separating the good sponsors from the bad sponsors, you know, negotiating fee structures, negotiating access. If you look at individual angel deals, I probably see, you know, 10 of them a day have a ton of deal flow there. But to me, you know, they frankly, they all look good. And I know that, you know, they can't all be good. And so figuring out, well, do we have some way of adding alpha or adding value relative to, you know, 20 different incubators out there and the 50 different angel groups? We haven't really identified it yet, so not put a lot of time into that. Doesn't mean it's a bad asset class, just probably we're not set up to add a ton of value. If you look at crypto, yeah, a really interesting question. You know, in general, I'd say there is broad-based but pretty modest exposure. So probably about 40% of our members hold some crypto in their portfolio, but it's on average and a mean probably about 2% of the portfolio allocation. So, you know, maybe today with the run-up, call it, you know, 2.5% or 3%, but not a huge fraction of the portfolio. Of course, there are a handful of people who made, you know, tens, maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars in crypto in some cases because, you know, they're true believers and took a second mortgage on the house and went all into it. In other cases, just, hey, I read this interesting white paper, so I put $1,000 in, and then, you know, I woke up 10 years later and looked at my hard drive and realized I had a ton of money, you know, both lucky and good there. One thing that's interesting, though, is those folks who have made a huge fraction of their wealth in crypto, in general, they are not true believers. I think they say, hey, you know, this is a very interesting financial instrument, but it's the opposite of what I talk about with public equities. You know, most of them would say, I don't really own anything fundamentally here. This is a ticker symbol and a price. And so it has very interesting trading characteristics. But, you know, in, say, the recent market where it's been going up, it's not they've been selling entirely, but they've been pretty disciplined about diversifying into these other real asset classes, whether that's real estate or private equity or private credit or what have you, and, you know, diversifying their wealth. I think probably still believing in the long term, the trend is probably up and to the right for crypto. You know, I would, you know, I or the royal we say it's probably more likely that it hits Bitcoin hits 100,000 than it goes to zero, or at least hits 100,000 before it goes to zero. So not saying that's not going to keep going up, but again, not drinking the Kool-Aid and sort of not trying to become over allocated to it.
Just a couple of other things, conscious of time. I mean, obviously, you know, you're looking at a wide different kind of variety of opportunities. Do you, obviously, you get presented with lots of ideas. Do you kind of brainstorm, or how do you think about what things to prioritize, or how do you kind of generate about ideas about where to look for opportunities?
Yeah, really good question. I would say one thing that we do not do is we are not anyone's wealth manager. So I'm not saying, hey, Alan, your portfolio should be, you know, 25% PE and 25% private credit and 10% venture. It should be, you know, people have too many different, you know, needs, and that's not what we're set up to do. So what we try and do is say, hey, over the course of a year, let's say we're doing 10 to 15 deals, we want to bring a variety of deals there. If you're already in two search funds, it's a great asset class, but going to a third search fund is not really going to add that much. You should just allocate as much as you want to the two best sponsors, and the same thing for real estate, for private credit, for, you know, whiskey aging, crypto, et cetera. So we try and over the course of the year, bring a couple best in class across a broad variety of asset classes. You know, and I know that when we bring a deal that's swinging for the fences of, okay, you know, this one delivered their 35% last year, that's going to get more interest than we bring, hey, here's a bit of a eat your vegetables infrastructure fund at, you know, 10 or 11%. You know, it's going to attract fewer dollars, but we nevertheless try and intentionally bring a wide variety of things so that when people are trying to build a complete portfolio can say, okay, I know where I'm under allocating my portfolio. And so when I see an opportunity I really like, I'm going to kind of, you know, go deeper into that asset class there. I would say that's generically, you know, a couple other things. One is trying to, you know, spend time looking for those niche things, you know, like whiskey agent I gave you example for there. So we've spent a lot of time, I would say recently, looking for good oil and gas opportunities, you know, upstream development. Not that I'm saying that should be a huge part of somebody's portfolio, but again, it just has different return dynamics. You know, it has had, at least in recent years, extraordinarily good returns. Of course, we can't guarantee that those are going to continue, but at least, you know, like trend following, it has historic equity-like returns with less than perfect correlation. So the kind of thing that you would want to get access to, and, you know, like everything that has its own unique dynamics, in that case, probably driven by a lot of institutional capital not being able to participate there, which sort of drives up the return for those who can participate. So, you know, looking for that breadth of opportunities. And then, of course, you have to be a bit, a third thing would probably be being cognizant of the macro environment. You know, you mentioned interest rates. So I already talked about how probably no to real estate, yes to private credit. I think another thing that has been pretty attractive recently you know, it's possible that this opportunity will go away in the future if markets remain relatively stable. But recently, secondary shares have been something that we've had a lot of interest in. And, you know, basically what a secondary share is, you know, maybe I've been in some venture capital fund for the last 10 years and I just need liquidity and those companies aren't yet going public. You can step in and say, hey, I will buy your portfolio at 70 cents on the dollar. And so you get sort of an instant bump in your returns, presuming that you believe in the value of the underlying NAV. I'd say you can have secondary shares in almost any asset class. One that's been very interesting for us recently is actually real estate secondary shares, where, of course, we are not alone in having a lack of interest in owning real estate at the moment and getting in there. But what that's meant is that there are some funds that have been able to get access or buy in with some of the best sponsors, you know, very blue chip names. And we invested in one, you know, about a year and a half ago. And as I've been following their progress, they've been buying positions at not 70 cents on the dollar, but like 70% discounts. So they're buying at, you know, 30 and 40 cents on the dollar into these real estate funds. And I just, as bad as the damage has been in office and maybe the demand is permanently impaired, I don't really believe that the values have gone down 70% in the real estate sector. But, you know, there's secondaries also have these other dynamics of, you know, if you're just trying to close out your fund and you have a 1% position left, you don't really care about maximizing your value in that 1% position. You just want to get the thing closed. And so you're willing to sell it at 50% discount, even if you could hold, you know, save money by holding on for another year. So anyway, I'd say secondary shares are an example of maybe being opportunistic to what the market environment looks like. And then there's also always just a bit of opportunistic of, again, there's, you know, certain managers who, if they ever open a fund again, or if we can ever get access, you're just going to want to jump on it regardless of the macro environment, because you know that that is a, you know, proven winner and one that over the long term is going to perform well. So when you have the opportunity, you got to go for it.
Okay. Good stuff. Just before we wrap up, we always want to get people's advice or suggestions. I mean, particularly from your perspective, you are obviously in business and then kind of migrated into being a heavier focus on asset allocation and investing. I mean, as you went through that process, were the things you read that you found particularly informative, or what advice would you give to people who want to get more proficient at investing and finding opportunities in markets and more broadly?
Yeah, excellent question. I would say if I was doing some reflecting on, hey, what are my best investments and least successful investments? And I had probably two takeaways from that. I would say on the least successful investments, it's complementing all of this quantitative analysis that we've just been talking about with more trust and intuition on people who, hey, all the numbers seem to work, the logic seems to work, but just my gut is telling me there's something off with this guy. Either it's too good to be true, you know, he's throwing around terms that I don't really understand. He's not, you know, answering. I'm asking questions and they're kind of getting brushed off as, hey, I don't have time to answer that question. I got to focus on the operations sort of thing. Of course, some of those ones where your intuition tells you it's a bad deal will turn out to be fine. But I can't think of many bad deals we've done where I didn't have some of that, you know, gut intuition of like something feels off here. And you sort of say, hey, I'm going to trust my head, not my gut here. I'm going to go forward with it because it seems like a good deal. So I'd say that's one thing that we've been trying to do is do all of your rigorous numbers, but also just do a gut check of, you know, are we nervous about, you know, writing this check? Does something feel a little bit off? And then the other one would probably be on the more positive side of the good deals. I would say it's position sizing and particularly being more aggressive when you have high conviction. Like I can give you two examples, one where I was aggressive and one where I wasn't. You know, about 10 years ago, I had super high conviction on Apple. As I looked at it, I say, okay, if we back out their cash position, they're trading at 3 to 4 times cash flow. You know, I think they've got great products. I think, you know, they're going to continue to do well, but I don't have to believe that. All I have to believe is they're going to stay in business like they are today for 3 more years. So can they make it to 2017 without blowing up? That seemed like, okay, almost certainly, you know, they'd never have to innovate with, they don't even have to come out with a new version of the iPhone. They can just, you know, keep doing the same thing for a couple of years. And I've guaranteed my downside. So I had super high conviction. You know, of course, that position that I bought then is up 1,000% probably since I bought it, but I only put in maybe $10,000. So, okay, it's great. You know, it's nice to get 10X on $10,000, but it's not a life-changing outcome. if I had really said, hey, I spent my time doing my research, I've got conviction, I should have put in, you know, $100,000 or $1 million if I'd had the money at the time, but really, you know, put the courage behind it, you know, which I didn't. And so the fact I had that insight wasn't particularly valuable. The flip side is, you know, where I did put the money behind, as I said, about 3 years ago, you know, during COVID, found this real estate opportunity where I said, okay, it was in a town called Santa Barbara, which is in Southern California. And I happen to know, because I have a lot of family there and own some property in Southern California, that the other markets in Southern California, like Orange County and Los Angeles, had gone up. They'd probably doubled in value over the last 10 years. But for reasons that just did not seem logical to me, Santa Barbara was just trading the same price that it was 10 years ago. Then you combine that with, okay, I can borrow at 2.5% and inflation is already higher than 2.5% and certainly going higher. And then this particular property, I just understand the dynamics of it. I've spoken to a number of, you know, brokers. They think it could rent out for this much. So I really did my research. I had conviction that, you know, this one is a, you know, quote, can't lose. Of course, nothing's can't lose, but I really liked this risk return skew on it. So at that point, I put half my net worth in, just saying, I'm going to go all in on this. And that turned out super well. So I think being willing to make big bets when the position size, the setup seems good for you. Again, that's probably around understanding the particular micros of that deal, as opposed to, you know, am I going to put a big bet on iron ore today because I think China's going to come back? Yeah, I don't really know anything. Anybody else doesn't know about that. Those would be sort of the tactical things. In terms of, you know, reading or books that I found valuable, probably the single best one really was Warren Buffett's. You know, I've read probably every annual letter that he's written there. And he very much, you know, has that perspective of, I am buying companies, I'm not buying pieces of paper here. And then, funny, great writer. And of course, you know, just deep insights on what the economic drivers are. You know, he's far smarter than either of us, but I think a lot of wisdom that you can pick up from those. I'd say for those who are, you know, this is not going to be for your institutional endowment manager, but for those who are more, you know, individuals who are looking either to be a better client of a wealth manager and understand what they're buying, or who don't want to have a wealth manager and, you know, want to be able to do it themselves. I think that both Dave Swenson, who was the longtime extremely successful endowment manager at Yale, and Jack Bogle, who started Vanguard, they both had books called Pioneering Portfolio Management and Common Sense Investing that are great at just laying out, hey, you know, here's what basic asset allocation and diversification looks like. Here's, you know, key asset classes. Here's how to think about expenses, now think about taxes, et cetera. So I think those are really valuable books.
Won't disagree with any of that. Some great suggestions there. So Tad, thanks very much for coming on today. It's been a really great insight and tremendous conversation. So thank you very much. So to all our listeners, make sure to follow Tad's work, because as you can tell from today's conversation, it's an uncertain and changing financial landscape, but there are plenty of opportunities out there. So from all of us here at Top Traders Unplugged, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back soon with more exciting episodes.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.